This is Medieval Death Trip for Thursday, April 30th, 2026, Episode 121, Concerning Seizure and Possession, Part 1, The Greek Tradition. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. I'd like to open this episode with a quote. Here's a bit of poetry rather vividly describing a particular affliction. Oft to some wretch before our startled sight, struck as with lightning by some keen disease, drops sudden, by the dread attack o'erpowered, he foams, he groans, he trembles, and he faints, now rigid, now convulsed, his laboring lungs heave quick and quivers each exhausted limb. Spread through the frame, so deep the dire disease perturbs his spirit, as the briny mane foams through each wave beneath the tempest's ire. He groans, since every member smarts with pain, and from his inmost breast, with wantless toil, confused and harsh, articulation springs. He raves, since soul and spirit are alike disturbed throughout, and severed each from each, as urged above, distracted by the bane. But when, at length, the morbid cause declines, and the fermenting humors from the heart flow back, with staggering foot the man first treads, led gradual on to intellect and strength. That was the Roman poet and Epicurean philosopher Lucretius, writing in his poem De Rerum Natura, or On the Nature of Things, in the 1st century BCE, as translated from the Latin by John Mason Good. Though Lucretius does not name the condition he's describing, it's nonetheless instantly recognizable. Certainly, we can say that this person is having a seizure, and if we assume that this is something they experience with some regularity, then this is a description of epilepsy. Last episode, as we listened to the catalog of miracles that occurred at St. Winifred's Well, we heard a couple of accounts of epilepsy being cured by the waters of the Holy Spring. In examining how those cures are described, we find ourselves with an interesting little case study for a particular question in medieval culture. That question is, was epilepsy perceived as a natural disease or a supernatural affliction, namely demonic possession? Many medieval descriptions of people said to be possessed line up pretty squarely with the symptoms of epilepsy. But then you'll find a text like the Miracles of St. Winifred, in which the condition is named, with the Latin epilentia in that text, epilepsia more commonly elsewhere. And in that text, we see that condition being cured alongside deformities and blindness and other things we would generally put in the bucket of natural diseases. Now, I'm going to give the game away a bit before someone out there gets very irate with my framing of this question, and just say that for many medieval people, and ancient people as well, this was not an either-or question, natural or supernatural, and their answer could be, why can't it be both? Actually, probably what they'd say first is, can you define for me what you mean by natural and supernatural? Because I'm not sure that distinction means the same thing to you, strange future person, as it means to me. In this episode and the next, we're going to conduct a little survey of historical primary sources that feed into how epilepsy was understood in the Middle Ages, culminating with a featured selection from a 14th century physician's discussion of what it is and how to treat it. There's a lot of interesting material to look at, so that's why we're going to do this in two parts. Today, in part one, we'll hear mostly from ancient sources, though we'll get as far as the 7th century CE by the end. Next episode, part two, we'll hit our later medieval sources and revisit the healings at St. Winifred's Well. But let's start with our current definitions. Very, very briefly, what is epilepsy per the modern medical understanding? Well, according to the Glossary of Descriptive Terminology for Ictal Semiology from 2001, quote, the term epilepsy is used to mean A, an epileptic disorder defined as a chronic neurological condition characterized by recurrent epileptic seizures, or B, epilepsies defined as those conditions involving chronic recurrent epileptic seizures that can be considered epileptic disorders. End quote. Look, I may just be a humble English major, and while I do hold a doctorate, I'm not qualified to stand up if a flight attendant asks if there's a doctor on board. But I do have to say, I don't think that's a very good definition. It sounds to my ear very tautological. It'd be like saying, Cancer is a disease defined by the growth of cancerous tissues. You've barely taken one step beyond just saying, cancer is a disease in which the patient has cancer. Or, in this case, epilepsy is a disease in which patients exhibit an epileptic disorder. But, to be fair to the medical community, I think what we're seeing here is the fact that the different types of epileptic seizure have already been defined, and so the definition of epilepsy as a broader syndrome is based on the frequency of those seizures. It sounds backwards because the adjective in epileptic seizure implies that you already know what epilepsy is, but in fact, at our current point in the long history of these terms, the definition flows the other direction, from the symptoms up to the umbrella term. We know what an epileptic seizure is, and the recurrence of those seizures is what we can call epilepsy as a disorder. We'll see a part of that terminological history in some of our ancient and medieval texts, where in their use of the term epilepsy and its synonyms, they're often talking about the experience of a seizure rather than a chronic condition as we mean it when we talk about someone having epilepsy. Now, the medieval people certainly understood epilepsy as a chronic condition as well. They'll just also use the word to mean an individual seizure. So whereas we would say that a person with epilepsy had a seizure, a medieval writer might phrase it that a person with epilepsy experienced epilepsy or was visited with epilepsy. That's important for understanding how they talk about cures and preventatives. When they explain certain cures for epilepsy, sometimes they're just talking about mitigating a seizure in the moment or preventing it from progressing past the initial perceptions of a seizure, the aura. They don't necessarily mean a lifelong cure for the condition. And what is that condition? Well, as the definition suggests, it is the state of being susceptible to certain kinds of seizures. And modern research has led to the recognition that really there are different neurological conditions that have all been grouped under the term epilepsy. And so two people who have both been diagnosed as epileptic may well have different fundamental causes of it, significantly different manifestations of it, and benefit from different treatments. What matters, as the medical definition indicates, is just that both people experience recurring seizures. Even if those seizures are of different kinds, so long as they are fundamentally linked to abnormal electrical discharges in the brain. Because there are other seizure disorders that aren't considered epilepsy, and these generally have other physiological or even psychological causes. But you could be born with a form of epilepsy that is a product of genetics, or you could acquire a form of epilepsy from injury to the brain or as a consequence of an infection like encephalitis or toxoplasmosis. All that said, while we know much more about epilepsy now in the 21st century than we did in the eras we'll be looking at more in a moment, it is still a condition with a fair number of mysteries yet to be solved surrounding its causes and treatments, as is true for many neurological disorders. The brain is a very complicated system and not easy to observe. Again, it's an amazing technological achievement that it's observable at all, and we only began being able to measure the brain's electrical activity in the 1890s. Which, frankly, is still several decades earlier than I would have thought before I started reading up on the subject. But our ancient and medieval physicians were truly flying blind as far as working out what was actually happening inside their patients' heads, and it's kind of impressive that they did as well as they did. Well, in some examples, anyway. There are several different types of epileptic seizure, and we'll see our pre-modern sources actually identifying several of them, so I won't run through the full state of modern classifications. But a thing to establish for anyone who doesn't know much about epilepsy is that the stereotypical falling on the ground with convulsions type of seizure, as depicted in the Lucretius excerpt I opened with, is just one type. There are also so-called absence seizures, where the person just kind of blanks out, sometimes like they've been put on pause or gone into slow motion, lasting from a few seconds to half a minute. In the old, now outmoded terminology, these two ends of the seizure spectrum were differentiated as grand mal versus petit mal seizures, or major and minor seizures, but modern medicine recognizes many more distinct modes of seizure between these two. Some seizures come with auras, various sorts of abnormal sensory perceptions that presage the oncoming seizure. We'll talk more about which of our ancient physicians coined that term a little bit later. Epileptic seizures can be triggered by many things. Again, a fact observed in our ancient and medieval writers. Common triggers include lack of sleep, use of drugs and alcohol or caffeine, stress, and diet, especially going too long without eating, getting dehydrated, or changes in blood sugar. Probably the most culturally well-known trigger for an epileptic seizure, flashing lights or shimmering lights or certain repetitive visual patterns, only affects about 3% of people with epilepsy. Which sounds like a small percentage, but it still represents a sizable number of people, especially as epilepsy affects an estimated 50 million people worldwide today. But I just wanted to highlight that the statement, strobe lights will cause epileptic seizures, is not as universal or definitional to epilepsy as I think a lot of people assume. So, those are the barest of bones, but hopefully this gives us a reasonable starting point and sets aside some potential misconceptions about epilepsy. I do want to acknowledge that I don't have epilepsy and I haven't had the chance to talk to anyone with epilepsy about it. Everything I'm sharing here comes from secondary medical sources, and I don't want to make any false pretensions to an expertise I do not have. And I'll confess that I'm deliberately not diving too deeply into the modern clinical understanding and treatment of epilepsy because I don't want to unintentionally misrepresent anything out of my own ignorance. But I also worry that a lot of people, and I would have put my younger self into this group, think they have a solid sense of what epilepsy is, but really that sense has been formed from depictions in literature and cinema and is consequently rather lacking. You probably have heard the old-fashioned name for epilepsy, the falling sickness or falling disease, and many ancient languages have essentially their own versions of that exact same phrase to describe epilepsy, or I guess to be precise, we should say conditions that we believe to have been epilepsy or included epilepsy. But as I mentioned, even ancient cultures recognized a broader spectrum of nonetheless related seizure modalities than just the grand mal seizure. So let's start our historical survey with one of the oldest written descriptions of epilepsy, in which we can already see a focus on distinguishing different types. This is from a Babylonian medical text known as the Sakiku, which translates to all diseases. This passage on epilepsy is preserved in two copies on separate cuneiform tablets, one that was found in southern Turkey, and another that is currently in the British Museum's Babylonian collection and lacks full provenance, but most likely is indeed from Babylon. This section of the Sakiku is all about a disease called Miktu in Akkadian, which translates to, take a guess, the falling disease. The text consists of a number of statements that, while not visually arranged as bullet points on the tablet, rhetorically operate that way. So I've just selected a few of them that highlight how this text does diagnosis. It identifies specific symptoms and then explains what underlying cause of disease is indicated by those symptoms. In this case, in the Babylonian understanding of epilepsy, the causes are supernatural. Actual treatments aren't specified on the tablet, but we can assume that since the treatment will always involve some form of banishing spirits or exorcism, then identifying what type of spirit you're dealing with is all the healer needs to be told, and then they'll know from other sources how to deal with that type of spirit. Read aloud, some of these statements will sound a little weird and ungrammatical. That's because the tag identifying the offending entity is often just stuck on to the end. This translation does it with a dash. So, that's what's happening when you hear a weird noun fragment. And now, here are a handful of types of falling disease from the Babylonian Sakiku, as translated by J.V. Kinnear Wilson and E.H. Reynolds, with some reconstructions of missing or unclear phrases. If epilepsy falls once upon a person, or falls many times, it is as the result of possession by a demon or a departed spirit. If an epilepsy demon falls again and again upon him, his eyes are suffused with blood, and he blinks his eyes, if his lower cheek areas twitch and his hands and feet are extended, if, when the exorcists come to see him, hope is perishing that he will ever regain consciousness, hand of the ghost of a murderer, he will die. If at the time of his fit, after it has taken hold of him, foam comes from his mouth, hand of Lilu. If at the time of his possession, while he is sitting down, his left eye moves to the side, a lip puckers, saliva flows from his mouth, and his hand, leg, and trunk on the left side jerk like a newly slaughtered sheep, it is Miktu. If at the time of possession his mind is consciously aware, the demon can be driven out. If at the time of possession his mind is not so aware, the demon cannot be driven out. If a death wail sounds forth for him, and at each wail he himself responds to it, saying as the wail sounds forth, "Who are you?" A Mutilu demon has affected him or become involved with him. When he stands at the head of his bed, he will die. So, there's Babylonian Miktu. And this spiritual explanation for seizures provides the baseline conception of the causality of seizures for most ancient cultures, at least to the west of the Indus River. Attacks by malign spirits or the touch of a deity were the common explanations for most neurological conditions that had no obvious connection to an injury or physiological symptom. There's even some thought that the surprisingly widespread evidence of prehistoric trepanation, the deliberate making of holes in the skull of a living person, may show attempts to treat epilepsy with the idea that you make a hole in the head to let the evil out. But not all ancient authorities shared that view. Hippocrates of Cos, often deemed the father of Western medicine, he of the Hippocratic Oath, firmly believed that epilepsy was caused by natural processes. Well, he probably believed that. More accurately, we can say that this position is argued by a text called On the Sacred Disease, long attributed to Hippocrates, though more likely, its actual author was instead a fellow practitioner of the Hippocratic school. The text has been dated to the late 5th century BCE, which is right in the heyday of Hippocrates' career, so for simplicity, we'll bow to tradition and refer to this author as Hippocrates. Now, in contrast to our Babylonian perspective on seizures, Greek culture did not ascribe them primarily to the actions of demons or other evil spirits or ghosts, though sometimes they did. More commonly, though, seizures were thought to be sent by a deity. Often Selene, the moon goddess, was specifically referenced, tying epilepsy in with broader ancient notions of lunacy, abnormal mental states tied to the effects of the moon in its changing phases. But make no mistake, despite the rather grand epithet of the sacred disease and the notions of being touched by the divine, epilepsy was highly stigmatizing in the Greco-Roman world. It was thought to be contagious, a belief that persisted into the Middle Ages. The Romans in particular had one custom for warding off contamination from an epileptic fit, and that was to spit the contagion back upon the one thought to be emanating it. The playwright Plautus gives epilepsy, or maybe lunacy more broadly, depending on how you read the line, he gives it the epithet, the disease which is spit upon. So this is the cultural context of the classical world which Hippocrates is challenging. And he opposes it with his own understanding of human biology, which, like most ancient and medieval science, features some surprisingly accurate observations undermined by unfortunate misconceptions. So, a big anatomical misconception featured in the text we'll be hearing is the Hippocratic theory of circulation. Now, it's commonly said that the Greeks believed that blood vessels circulated not blood, but air, presumably reinforced by the fact that if you dissect a body that's been dead for a while, you won't find liquid blood in the veins, and they will appear to be just hollow tubes. But first, that last statement is not exactly true, and second, it's hard to believe that a culture that slaughtered and butchered animals wouldn't notice where the blood comes from when you cut an animal's throat. However, as you will hear in a second, Hippocrates does postulate the flow of air through vessels into the brain. And elsewhere in the Hippocratic writings, you'll find one Greek word, arteriae, from which the English word artery ultimately derives, used to mean, yes, arteries, but also, and more prominently, the trachea and bronchial passages. So, the more complicated answer is that the classical view of the circulatory system was confused. They certainly understood that there was blood in blood vessels, or at least in some blood vessels, but they also identified some of the larger vessels as having a pneumatic function. Which brings us to one other key term to define, pneuma, or as the ancient Greeks would have pronounced it, without the silent P, pneuma. Pneuma means breath, and is associated with the air we breathe in and out, but also with the concept of a vital, airy energy that moves through the body and, for Hippocrates, carries the will of the brain out to the limbs. The philosophers distinguish it from psyche, psuche, the breath of life or soul, which Plato denotes as being the immortal part of the person, and which later takes on the notion of mind and consciousness. Roman authors carry this pairing into Latin. We see it in the Lucretius passage, in the lines, He raves, since soul and spirit are alike, disturbed throughout and severed each from each. The distinction is quite subtly represented there by the difference between the two Latin words animus, translated as soul, and anima, translated spirit. Anima is pneuma, the force that animates the body. This carries on into medieval theology as the terminology to distinguish between that energy which gives the body life and the immortal soul, and explains how things can be alive but lack souls, as when, say, the soul has been carried off to be given a tour of the horrors of hell and the pleasures of heaven. Oh, and also to account for animals being alive while lacking souls made in the image of God. But before Plato and Aristotle, during Hippocrates' time, the distinction hasn't been quite so sharpened. What applies here is that Hippocrates sees epilepsy stemming from obstruction in the flow of pneuma to and from the brain. He also mentions a concept related to fetal development. The process is termed depuration by our translator, and as best as I can piece together, the idea is that the fetus in utero obviously is not breathing, and so the vessels and cavities within the brain that should carry pneuma are full of fluid, other humors of the body, especially phlegm, and this fluid and other impurities of the brain matter have to be flushed out or purged, and that is the process of depuration. As Hippocrates will argue, problems with this process can lead to childhood epilepsy. And so, we get the mixed legacy of Hippocrates. His core argument here, that the disease has a natural cause in the brain, is ahead of its time. But the actual explanation for what is happening in the brain is held back by the knowledge of the time. Oh, and one last English vocabulary note. You'll hear epilepsy referred to as an affection here. You would be forgiven for assuming that that was me foolishly misreading affliction, but no, affection is the word our translator uses. In this case, he's relating it back to its original Latin usage, where affectionem meant a disposition, a state one could be in, a condition. In English, affection experiences elevation or amelioration, a type of semantic change in which a word acquires a more positive meaning, which is a bit less common than its opposite, degeneration or perjuration, in which word takes on a more negative meaning over time, as famously happened with egregious, which originally meant outstanding, excellent. Etymologically, it means coming out of the herd or flock, but now means outrageous or glaringly bad. These are some of my favorite types of semantic change because they can make reading older texts unintentionally hilarious. For affection, it goes from being just any kind of disposition to specifically a positive disposition towards something else. All right, back on track. We'll start with the opening argument of the text and then skip to the anatomical theory. So, here begins On the Sacred Disease by a physician of the Hippocratic school, as translated from the ancient Greek by Francis Adams. It is thus with regard to the disease called sacred. It appears to me to be nowise more divine nor more sacred than other diseases, but has a natural cause from which it originates, like other affections. Men regard its nature and cause as divine from ignorance and wonder, because it is not at all like other diseases. And this notion of its divinity is kept up by their inability to comprehend it, and the simplicity of the mode by which it is cured, for men are freed from it by purifications and incantations. But if it is reckoned divine because it is wonderful, instead of one, there are many diseases which would be sacred. For, as I will show, there are others no less wonderful and prodigious which nobody imagines to be sacred. The quotidian, tertian, and quartan fevers seem to me no less sacred and divine in their origin than this disease, although they are not reckoned so wonderful. And I see men become mad and demented from no manifest cause, and at the same time doing many things out of place, and I have known many persons in sleep groaning and crying out, some in a state of suffocation, some jumping up and fleeing out of doors, and deprived of their reason until they awaken, and afterwards becoming well and rational as before, although they be pale and weak. And this will happen not once, but frequently. And there are many and various things of the like kind which it would be tedious to state particularly. and they who first referred this disease to the gods appear to me to have been just such persons as the conjurers, purificators, mountebanks, and charlatans now are, who give themselves out for being excessively religious and as knowing more than other people. Such persons then, using the divinity as a pretext and screen of their own inability to afford any assistance, have given out that the disease is sacred. Adding suitable reasons for this opinion, they have instituted a mode of treatment which is safe for themselves, namely by applying purifications and incantations and enforcing abstinence from baths and many articles of food which are unwholesome to men in diseases. Of sea substances, the surmullet, the blacktail, the mullet, and the eel, for these are the fishes most to be guarded against. And of fleshes, those of the goat, the stag, the sow, and the dog, for these are the kinds of flesh which are aptest to disorder the bowels. Of fowls, the cock, the turtle, and the bustard, and such others as are reckoned to be particularly strong. And of potherbs, mint, garlic, and onions, for what is acrid does not agree with a weak person. And they forbid to have a black robe, because black is expressive of death, and to sleep on a goat skin or to wear it, and to put one foot upon another, or one hand upon another, for all these things are held to be hindrance to the cure. All these they enjoin with reference to its divinity, as if possessed of more knowledge, and announcing beforehand other pretense, so that if the person should recover, theirs would be the honor and credit, and if he should die, they would have a certain defense, as if the gods and not they were to blame, seeing they had administered nothing either to eat or drink as medicine, nor had overheated him with baths so as to prove the cause of what had happened. But I am of the opinion that, if this were true, none of the Libyans who live in the interior would be free from this disease, since they all sleep on goat skins and live upon goat's flesh. Neither have they couch, robe, nor shoe that is not made of goat skin, for they have no other herds but goats and oxen. But if these things, when administered in food, aggravate the disease, and if it be cured by abstinence from them, then is God not the cause at all? Nor will purifications be of any avail, but it is the food which is beneficial and prejudicial, and the influence of the divinity vanishes. Thus, then, they who attempt to cure these diseases in this way appear to me neither to reckon them sacred nor divine. For when they are removed by such purifications and this method of cure, what is to prevent them from being brought upon men and influenced by other devices similar to these? So that the cause is no longer divine, but human. For whoever is able by purifications and conjurations to drive away such an affection will be able, by other practices, to excite it, and according to this view, its divine nature is entirely done away with. Here we'll jump ahead a few pages in the text to hear more of the Hippocratic theory of the disease's causes. The brain of man, as in all other animals, is double, and a thin membrane, minix, divides it through the middle, and therefore the pain is not always in the same part of the head, for sometimes it is situated in either side, and sometimes the whole is affected, and veins run towards it from all parts of the body, many of which are small, but two are thick, the one from the liver and the other from the spleen. By these veins we draw in much spirit, for they are the spiracles of our bodies, inhaling air to themselves and distributing it to the rest of the body, and to the smaller veins, and they cool and afterwards exhale it. For the breath, pneuma, cannot be stationary, but it passes upwards and downwards, for if stopped and intercepted, the part where it is stopped becomes powerless. In proof of this, when, in sitting or lying, the small veins are compressed so that the breath, pneuma, from the larger vein does not pass into them, the part is immediately seized with numbness, and it is so likewise with regard to the other veins. This disease, then, affects phlegmatic persons, but not bilious. It begins to be formed when the fetus is still in utero. For the brain, like the other organs, is depurated and grows before birth. If, then, in this purgation it be properly and moderately depurated, and neither more nor less than what is proper be secreted from it, the head is thus in the most healthy condition. If the secretion, or melting, from the whole brain be greater than natural, the person, when he grows up, will have his head diseased and full of noises, and will neither be able to endure the sun nor cold. Or, if the melting take place from any one part, either from the eye or ear, or if a vein has become slender, that part will be deranged in proportion to the melting. Or, if the depuration does not take place, but it, the secretion, accumulates in the brain, it necessarily becomes phlegmatic. And such children as have an eruption of ulcers on the head, on the ears, and along the rest of the body, with copious discharges of saliva and mucus, these, in later life, enjoy best health, for in this way the phlegm, which ought to have been purged off in the womb, is discharged and cleared away, and persons so purged, for the most part, are not subject to attacks of this disease. But such as have had their skin free from eruptions, and have had no discharge of saliva or mucus, nor have undergone the proper purgation in the womb, these persons run the risk of being seized with this disease. But if the defluxion be determined to the heart, the person is seized with palpitation and asthma, the chest becomes diseased, and some also have curvature of the spine. For when a defluxion of cold phlegm takes place on the lungs and heart, the blood is chilled, and the veins, being violently chilled, palpitate in the lungs and heart, and the heart palpitates, so that from this necessity, asthma and orthopnea supervene. For it does not receive the spirits, pneuma, until the defluxion of phlegm be mastered, and, being heated, is distributed to the veins, then it ceases from its palpitation and difficulty of breathing, and this takes place as soon as it obtains an abundant supply. And this will be more slowly, provided the deflection be more abundant, or, if it be less, more quickly. And if the deflections be more condensed, the epileptic attacks will be more frequent, but otherwise it will be rarer. Such are the symptoms when the deflection is upon the lungs and heart. But if it be upon the bowels, the person is attacked with diarrhea. And if, being shut out from all these outlets, its deflections be determined to the veins I have formerly mentioned, the patient loses his speech and chokes, and foam issues by the mouth, the teeth are fixed, the hands are contracted, the eyes distorted, he becomes insensible, and in some cases the bowels are evacuated. And these symptoms occur sometimes on the left side, sometimes on the right, and sometimes in both. The cause of every one of these symptoms I will now explain. The man becomes speechless when the phlegm, suddenly descending into the veins, shuts out the air and does not admit it either to the brain or to the vena cava or to the ventricles, but interrupts the inspiration. For when a person draws in air by the mouth and nostrils, the breath, pneuma, goes first to the brain, then the greater part of it to the internal cavity, and part to the lungs, and part to the veins, and from them it is distributed to the other parts of the body along the veins, and whatever passes to the stomach cools and does nothing more, and so also with regard to the lungs. But the air which enters the veins is of use to the body by entering the brain and its ventricles, and thus it imparts sensibility and motion to all the members, so that when the veins are excluded from the air by the phlegm and do not receive it, the man loses his speech and intellect, and the hands become powerless and are contracted, the blood stopping and not being diffused as it was wont, and the eyes are distorted owing to the veins being excluded from the air, and they palpitate, and froth from the lungs issues by the mouth. For when the breath, pneuma, does not find entrance to him, he foams and sputters like a dying person. And the bowels are evacuated in consequence of the violent suffocation, and the suffocation is produced when the liver and stomach ascend to the diaphragm and the mouth of the stomach is shut up. This takes place when the breath, pneuma, does not enter by the mouth as it is wont. The patient kicks with his feet when the air is shut up in the lungs and cannot find an outlet owing to the phlegm. And rushing by the blood upwards and downwards, it occasions convulsions and pain, and therefore he kicks with his feet. All these symptoms he endures when the cold phlegm passes into the warm blood, for it congeals and stops the blood. So, there's an ancient natural explanation for epilepsy. While what mostly stands out now are the errors about human physiology, what should be impressive is the Hippocratic insight that this is fundamentally a condition of the brain, and indeed, that it involves disruption of the signals of the brain. Hippocrates models that as a flow of air through vessels rather than electricity across neurons, but he's closer to the mark than we might expect someone to be who has access to virtually no diagnostic tools beyond their own five senses and, I guess, a knife, and that rarely enough. Indeed, until the advent of EEG in the 1920s, medical explanations for the cause of epilepsy remained largely mechanical, meaning they still postulated some form of physical observable obstruction in the brain or nerves, or physical damage like lesions on the nerves. So while the understanding of anatomy is much advanced from the time of Hippocrates, you'll still find Victorian researchers theorizing about seizures being caused by, quote, discharges of gray matter from the brain, end quote, that don't sound that far removed from Hippocrates' notion of incomplete depuration of the brain or clogging up of the cerebral ventricles by viscous phlegm. In fact, one lingering legacy of this belief is the name of the pituitary gland. Latin pituita means mucus, phlegm, slime, and the gland was so named because it was thought to secrete phlegm or mucus, which would eventually exit through the nose. Today, we know that rather than mucus, the pituitary gland secretes vital hormones, which is the other way the brain regulates the body besides electrical impulses. So, once again, our ancient physicians were wrong, but wrong in a way that was still weirdly close for people working 2,000 years before the existence of hormones was first properly theorized by medical science. Our Hippocratic author does not go into details about treatments for epilepsy, other than falling back on the standard theory of balancing the four humors and their corresponding properties. He writes, quote, "But whoever is acquainted with such a change in men, and can render a man humid and dry, hot and cold by regimen, could also cure this disease, if he recognizes the proper season for administering his remedies, without minding purifications, spells, and all other illiberal practices of like kind," end quote. To see a classical therapy in action, we have to jump ahead several centuries to around the year 190 CE, and to Galen, the author most responsible for setting up the pillars of medicine upon which most educated medieval practice would rest. Galen continues the core theories and principles of the Hippocratic school, adding a few improvements to anatomical understanding of his own. But if he's not radically changing medicine, why is he so influential? The answer is output. Though he is a subject of the Roman Empire, and eventually physician to multiple emperors, including Marcus Aurelius, he was born in the Greek city of Pergamon, located in present-day Turkey, or Turkia, and he wrote in Greek, though many native Romans also wrote in Greek, as it remained the dominant language of high culture and education, not unlike French for a medieval English person. But the point here is that more words of Galen survive in our corpus of ancient Greek texts than any other single author. And there's less debate around authorship for most of these texts compared to Hippocrates. Galen alone accounts for about 3% of all the literature written in ancient Greek that we have preserved today. And that's with only about a third of everything Galen ever wrote surviving, as we know from ancient references and book lists. We have about 3 million words of Galen today, just a little under Charles Dickens' lifetime output of 4.5 million, but it's thought that Galen probably wrote close to 10 million words of texts, which makes him more than a double Dickens and just short of Stephen King, who is getting into the ballpark of 12 million published words. And yet, not one blockbuster film adaptation of Galen. For shame, Hollywood. Who wouldn't want to see Whom to Purge, With What Cleansing Drugs, and When, starring Tom Hardy and Zendaya? Anyway, that's why Galen's shadow stretches so far. He literally wrote the book, or books, on what would become the fundamentals of Western medicine. Though, as with so much classical wisdom, his work fell into obscurity in Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire, being preserved first in the Byzantine Empire and then by scholars of the medieval Islamic world, and thence finding its way back into the Latin West in the later Middle Ages. Galen is strongly associated with humoral theory, though, as we heard, the basics were already laid out in Hippocrates' time. But Galen is credited with making it the dominant theory through the popularity of his texts. I'm guessing most of you have probably bumped into humoral theory at some point, and we don't need to know that much about it for this discussion, so here's the nutshell version. Humoral theory proposes that the health of the body is profoundly influenced by the balance of four essential substances or humors: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. These each embody a combination of two qualities, moisture and temperature. So blood is hot and wet, phlegm is cold and wet, yellow bile is warm and dry, and black bile is cold and dry. Different proportions of these in the body could cause disease states, and Galen has a whole treatise specifically on how they influence four corresponding temperaments, sanguine, phlegmatic, choleric, and melancholic, which continue to shape conceptions of personalities well into the early modern era, and continue to influence our terminology, if not our theories, all the way to the present day. Medically, many of Galen's interventions are oriented to rebalancing out-of-whack humors. And so, let's get to our author. The text we'll be hearing is a letter Galen wrote to a father seeking a medical consultation about his son who has epilepsy. The boy is already being treated by a doctor known to Galen and with whom he has already been corresponding, so this isn't the father seeking a second opinion, though it does feel a bit like he's asking to speak with the manager. Well, that is, if the manager were a celebrity. I guess it would be like going to a medical practice run by a famous TV doctor, but only ever getting to see the nurse practitioner. You might make a snotty request to actually be seen by the famous doctor, and the famous doctor may well respond as Galen does here. Look, my people know what they're doing. In fact, they know your case better than I do. But since your brother-in-law is the lieutenant governor, here's 10 minutes of my attention. So, let's hear some key passages from Galen's Advice for an Epileptic Boy, as translated by Oswy Timken. Dear Caecilianus, I thought you would not need our advice for your boy's disease. Dionysius has already seen him and is about to sail back to Athens together with you. He is competent to do what is necessary while he is present and to give new instructions according to the condition of the disease when he leaves. I, however, who have never seen the boy, might perhaps err very much since I was not acquainted with his original nature and do not know how it has been affected by the disease. All I heard from you is that he suffers from epileptic paroxysms. Now, you probably think that negligence rather than the desire for truth makes me evade writing, a thing of which I have never yet been guilty. So, to please you, I am going to write down some advice on the treatment of an epileptic boy. The layman will, of course, inevitably misunderstand the meaning and blunder as to the due measure or the right time of application, for we have shown in other writings that it is not possible, without a thorough study of the therapeutic method, to cure any of the smallest diseases, let alone such great ones as epilepsy. Dionysius has already communicated with me, and together we considered the whole treatment of the boy before you urged the writing of these instructions. I easily explained my opinion to him, for he is able to follow what one says without misunderstanding anything, since he is sufficiently trained in the therapeutic method. But I do not know how to go through the subject with you, for while that which is exact in it requires much elaboration and is too obscure for a layman, that which is concise and clear is, on the other hand, not exact. Thus, I hesitated to write the instructions, much as I wished to please you. It seemed to me that I should suffer something similar to what Phidias would have suffered if, after creating the statue of Athena, he had been compelled to create a finger, an arm, a foot, the nose, an ear, and each of the other parts all separately. For I think, like a statue, the therapeutic method has been created by me in several books, not, however, in a manner likely to help the layman or even the ordinary physician. Since you, however, compel me to take one part of the medical art as my subject, separated from the harmonious union with the rest, I yield in obedience to the compulsion and write such instructions as will be sufficient for you. For they suffice to prevent a layman, especially one who has in the usual way learned to be conversant with such writings, from making grave and irreparable mistakes in what the physicians prescribe. For physicians, the treatise on the therapeutic method has been written. For you, however, and for the others who have a knowledge of some rational arts but are laymen in medicine, some advantage may nevertheless accrue, as I believe, from the present writing. Galen next prescribes for the boy a morning regimen of light exercise and therapeutic massage, and then proceeds to outline a moderate diet, which we will skip ahead to. Thus, as I have said, after the exercises, he should partake at lunch of vinegar honey and eat some vegetables, olives, nuts, figs, and dried figs, but not all of them together every day. He should rather take one simple dish, but I mention all of them so that the diet may be varied. At this time, as has been said, the boy may also partake of the other tree fruits if he craves them, but otherwise it would be better to abstain from them, not only for the sake of curing the disease, but also in consideration of the whole state of health, as you see us too abstaining strictly from all seasonable food. But it is true, we do not write about a healthy regimen for philosophers, as I should like best to do, nor, on the other hand, do we write merely for the cure of the disease, but also concerning the whole life of your boy. Now, one must permit him to eat openly and at the right time things which do not cause great harm, lest he be harmed more by taking them secretly and at the wrong time. For people who are prevented from doing so openly fill themselves with what they desire all at once and in a larger quantity. I prefer to concede to children many such foods as, although not beneficial, do not do much harm if eaten openly and at the right time and with the necessary moderation, lest at the wrong time they be compelled by the vehement desire to eat more and greedily. This should be the arrangement regarding the food. So, there's just a portion of Galen's advice for a healthy lifestyle, and still pretty solid and modern-sounding advice, I think. After this midday meal, he prescribes for the boy more walking before resuming his studies, then a second walk after completing the day's studies, and before having dinner. But it's not all diet and exercise. He also prescribes taking certain drugs, especially various purgatives, such as concoctions of wormwood and squills. Squills being a flowering plant in the same family as asparagus, bluebells, and hostas. But this highlights a key part of the medical interventions of humoral theory. You gotta get those excess humors out, hence purging of the stomach or intestines, the application of strong spices to provoke mucus flow in the nose or from the eyes, and, of course, bleeding. As for more of Galen's contributions to the understanding of epilepsy, in a different text, he is credited with introducing the Greek term aura into medicine. Aura is Greek for breeze, and Galen used it to describe a patient's sensation of cold air moving up his body from his legs shortly before having a seizure. We still use aura today to describe sensory perturbations before seizures or migraines, and though the popular conception of auras associates them with visual experiences, they can involve any of the senses, as in the tactile experience of Galen's patient, but also odd sounds and smells. Indeed, what senses an aura manifests through can be diagnostic for which areas of the brain are involved in the disorder. I tried to determine if there is any clear link between medical aura and the paranormal concept of seeing people's psychic auras. Spiritualists started using aura in the 19th century to refer to spiritual emanations from a person, but with imagery that aligns with the original sense of feeling a breeze, you know, a wave of energy. So they may have just borrowed the Greek without specific reference to the auras of epilepsy. However, I have to wonder if the medical phenomenon, which is frequently visual, just not always, if that helped fuel the later emphasis on the perception of psychic auras as a visual experience, or at least something best described in visual imagery. But to wrap up with Galen, we should note how all of his prescriptions are for the treatment of a natural disease. None of the preparations or therapies involve charms or prayers or even the sympathetic magic of placing items on the body or wearing them. He remains a Hippocratic naturalist. That is the medical tradition which is sidelined in Western Europe through the so-called Dark Ages. But before we turn to what's happening in the West, which we'll do in part two, let's have a last dip into the Hippocratic tradition as continued in the Byzantine East. This is the tradition also picked up, preserved, and elaborated on by Islamic physicians such as Ibn Sina, known to the Latin-speaking world as Avicenna, who ranks right beside Galen for influence on later medieval medicine. He's writing in Persia in the early 11th century, and his book, The Canon of Medicine, is translated into Latin by Gerard of Cremona just 100 years later. And by the 13th century, it was being used as a standard medical textbook in Europe and remained so into the 1500s. I would have liked to have represented the Islamic tradition better here, but I could not get hold of an available English translation of the parts of the Canon of Medicine that discuss epilepsy in any detail. So instead, we'll hear a wonderfully descriptive passage from a 7th century Byzantine Greek physician, Paulus Aegineta, or Paul of Aegina. This is from Book 3 of his Medical Compendium in 7 Books, which is actually a big edited compilation of the writings of earlier doctors mixed with his own observations. I think this gives us our most detailed description of epilepsy so far, as well as the most vivid rundown of what some of the natural treatments entailed, here as we are nearing the peak of the development of the approach that started with Hippocrates. So, here is Paul of Aegina giving what has been called the first clinical description of epilepsy, as translated by Francis Adams. Oh, and a quick pop quiz. Do you remember what I just told you the Latin origin behind pituitary was? It's from the word for phlegm, and that knowledge is about to pay off. Here we go. Epilepsy, being a convulsion of the whole body with impairment of the primary energies, has its cause seated sometimes in the brain itself and sometimes in its cavities. This is sometimes a pituitous and sometimes a melancholic humor. The disease also sometimes arises from sympathy with the orifice of the stomach, as happens in colic affections, as will be stated when treating of them. And sometimes it is propagated from other parts, when a cold aura ascends to the brain, either from the leg or the fingers of the hand. It has also been seen to proceed from the uterus in females at the time they were pregnant, for after delivery, it ceased. This disorder attacks mostly the young, more especially infants, and after them, boys and adults, but least of all, elderly persons and the old. Its precursors are an involuntary commotion, both of mind and body, despondency, oblivion of accustomed things, terrifying visions and dreams, headache, continued fullness of the head, especially from acute anger, paleness of countenance, and an irregular motion of the tongue, so that some even bite it. When it proceeds from the stomach, palpitation thereof goes before, with disorder and aching pain, and when fasting or during a delayed meal, they fall into a paroxysm. When the attack comes on, they suddenly fall down, are convulsed, and sometimes utter inarticulate cries. The characteristic mark of these cases is foaming at the mouth, all other symptoms being common to other diseases. In certain instances, the urine and feces are evacuated involuntarily, and in some, the semen also. In some cases, when the disease is very acute, it proves fatal speedily by the continuance of the paroxysms or the violence of the attack, but it is most frequently protracted, so that, if it be not removed by the attainment of manhood, by purging, or pregnancy, or if it invade after this period of life, it, for the most part, does not leave a man until death, unless removed by a suitable cure. The following substances are used to prove epilepsy, namely the fumes of bitumen, or gagget stone, or goat's horns, or the liver of a buck goat when eaten, or the smell of the roasted liver. So, there are your diagnostic criteria of epilepsy, as per Paulus Aegineta. What does he recommend for treatment? Well, his first suggestion is to let the disease cure itself, as it will generally depart on its own after childhood or after pregnancy. But then he goes into other cures, starting with more acute treatments for the symptoms as they arise. We'll hear those in a second. First, a couple of quick vocabulary notes. A sinapism is a type of poultice. Sinapis is Latin for mustard, and this is specifically a mustard plaster, where mustard powder is applied to the skin under a covering, and the irritation of the skin is thought to have healing effects. The old logic behind it is definitely related to the humoral theory that sensation of heat on the skin counteracts cold humors like phlegm. You can still find mustard plasters for sale commercially today, among other alternative and herbal treatments. Related is Cyreniac juice, a remedy associated with the Greek city of Cyrene in what is now Libya. Interestingly, this concoction utilized a plant native to that area, silphium, which was such a highly desired export that it was over-harvested to extinction by the 2nd century CE. Or maybe growing herds of Libyan sheep ate it into extinction. Or possibly desertification of its narrow growing range pushed it over the edge. That's to say, we don't really know. We also don't know that it definitely went extinct, since we don't know exactly what plant the ancient writers were talking about. All we know for certain is that they report that it eventually could no longer be found, which might make it a candidate for our first written recognition of extinction centuries before the dodo. It does appear to have been closely related to fennel and asafoetida, which we know ancient people were already using as substitutes for it, and it may just have been a subspecies or cultivar of one of those. And, of course, we'll see it being recommended here in the 7th century by Paul, long after it disappeared, which is either a rote preservation of cures prescribed by the Hippocratics, or this shows that the name of the remedy, Cyreniac juice, had shifted to cover the use of the typical substitutes. And lastly, a different use of hypochondria. The Greek origins of hypochondria are hypo, under, and chondros, cartilage, or in this case, the so-called false ribs that don't attach to the sternum. So the hypochondria was the name for the upper abdomen. That's where the organs thought to produce black bile, melancholia, were situated. And so, over time, the state of the hypochondria became associated with depression prompted by no obvious external cause, and eventually took on its modern meaning of belief that one is sick without any real cause. But here, it still just means the upper abdomen below the ribs. And now, let's hear Paul of Aegineta presenting us with the cutting edge of Byzantine treatments for epilepsy. When the patient is an infant, we need not be particularly solicitous about it, for when its age changes to a more bilious and drier constitution and the diet is more prudently regulated, the affection will go off spontaneously. But we must attend to the diet, not only of the infants, but likewise of their wet nurses. After boyhood, those that fall into the disease ought to have the convulsed and distorted parts freely anointed, ligatures applied to them when they are to be stretched out, and then the mouth is to be opened, and one must introduce a finger or a feather smeared with oil of iris in order to bring away the phlegm. We must also rouse the senses by strong-smelling things, such as hog's fennel, cyreniac juice, bitumen, and the pitch of cedar. But after the paroxysms, if nothing prevent, we must bleed from the arm. And when the paroxysm does not abate, we must apply a synapsism to the extremities and a cupping instrument to the hypochondria. When, after these things, no remission takes place, there can be but little hope. And yet, the physician ought boldly to force castor into the mouth, and cyreniac juice with honey and vinegar, and the decoction of centuary or of colocynth must be injected by the anus. So, after this, Paulus continues his list of treatments with additional forms of essentially herbal remedies administered in different ways and in different combinations for all the different forms of the disease. Again, while we may be skeptical of the efficacy of many of these treatments, a key point is that, like the Hippocratics, Paulus is still approaching the disease as a natural disease treatable through natural methods. And, as I mentioned earlier, assorted nutrition issues are known seizure triggers, so a carefully managed diet could well be effective at reducing seizure frequency. So, if in the Latin West we lose the diet and exercise treatment, well, diet, exercise, and a whole lot of digestive trauma, purging from both ends, as it were, if that approach to understanding and treating epilepsy falls into shadow, what takes its place? Well, the supernatural explanation floods back in. Though really, it had never left. It's not like the Romans only listened to Galen. Galen, like Hippocrates, is still having to actively advocate for a natural understanding of disease against the many, many healers who deployed charms and magic and prayers in their cures. The main change is that as the former Roman Empire becomes Christian, there is a new institutional authority for both promulgating and regulating what kinds of healing can be done. And that's where we'll pick up next episode with part two of Concerning Seizure and Possession, which will focus a little more on the possession side. But while we're still hanging out with the Greeks, let's get today's mystery word. Our mystery word is lampaktikos. This is a Greek word, one that appears in Galen. It comes from the verb lampazo, to empty, but with a kind of aggressive connotation, since this verb is also used to mean to pillage, to sack, to really empty a place of its possessions. Medically, a lampaktikos is a laxative. It's kind of the partner to a word we covered way back in episode 25 concerning the deaths of Edgar and Edward in triptych. That word was drastikos, the root of English drastic, which meant an emetic. So that covers your two primary ways of evacuating the digestive system, which remained one of the central modes of medical treatment for most illnesses into the modern era. which actually isn't that surprising if you consider how much sickness probably could be attributed to foodborne illness and parasites. If you'd like to follow up on any of the old episodes I mentioned today or get full references for today's texts, you can find all that information along with links to our various social media accounts on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. You can also communicate with me there through comments on episode posts or by email to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com. If you'd like to support the show materially, you can do that on Patreon, where for as little as a dollar a month, you will get access to bonus audio content like appendices to some episodes, including this one, two feature film commentaries, one quasi-academic on the 1981 classic Dragon Slayer, and one live first watch reaction to The Green Knight from 2021. You'll also get a full audiobook of Friar Jordanus's Wonders of the East with footnotes by Sir Henry Yule. And it's a cancel-at-any-time kind of deal. Check it out at patreon.com/mdtpodcast. And a big thank you, as always, to all of our patrons. Adobe raised its prices yet again. Health insurance premiums shot up. So I just want to reiterate that your support is truly appreciated and is more valuable than ever for continuing the existence of this show. And we'll leave part one there and look forward to a more thoroughly medieval part two. Until then, keep your ears open for the death wail, and keep your eyes on the head of your bed, and thanks for listening.